For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, the title of our paragraph tonight is Living in the Last Days for Reasons That Will Become Evident When You Look at the First Sentence, which reads, realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Well, you know, the whole concept of the last days conjures up all manner of images. And there's a whole series of books out, in fact, that sold millions of copies about living in the last days. And this is it's a technical term. It's a term that's really has its origins all the way back in the 8th century writing of the prophet Joel. So 700 and some years before the time of Christ, this was a concept, a term that was used. And Jesus talks about this also quite a bit, that there is a window of time between Christ's first coming, where he comes and he offers himself for the sins of humanity, and that time where he returns to establish his personal rule on the earth. And that, in a broad sense, is what the last days refers to. It's that time that God has granted for human beings to exercise their God-given freedom to either pursue him with and take him up on the offer of a relationship with him through Christ, or to go their own way. So God's created us as free choosing beings, and he's allowed history to be the outworking of that free choice. Now, the Bible says that the outworking of the free choices of people who are separated from God, who are alienated from him, ends out badly, which is why you have images, apocalyptic images of the very end of the last days, which the Bible does describe, which Jesus talks about at some length in Matthew chapter 24. But there is also a broader understanding of this. Paul uses the word, he says, in the last days, difficult times will come. Chalepios in the Greek just means stressful times. In classical literature, it referred to harrowing difficulties that people would experience on a boat out in the Mediterranean Sea as a storm is coming on. And so that's maybe a better way to look at this, is that the window of time that God's given to humanity to choose to go our way, as we are given that opportunity, is a stressful time, because when you've got now, I guess we're being told, 7 billion different people with their own agendas for life, it's very complicated and indeed stressful. Last time we began talking some about one of the implications of living in the last times, which is this idea that people will just more or less decide that I myself am the standard of all truth. The Greeks, in fact, just prior to the time of Christ, actually coined this phrase that man is the measure of all things. And by that, what they meant was that I determine what's true for me. Now, you determine what's true for you, and that's on you. But everyone chooses for themselves what's true for them, the values that they live by, and so forth. And so the Bible describes this sort of anarchic picture of people going their own way and doing their own thing, really apart from God in their life. And so that's what Paul is describing in an ongoing way in this paragraph that we're looking at here this evening. Let's take a look. He says, here's why difficult times will come. He says, because the reality is that people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although denying its power. And those, of course, are the good qualities. And he says, avoid people like that. And then he goes on, he says, among these are people who enter into the households and captivate weak women weighed down by sins. By weak women, he means not that they're physically weak or something like that, but they're in a weak social position. And this is being manipulated by people, he says, who are led by various impulses, always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. And so that is quite a description, isn't it, of society in the last days. And the point that I want to make here this evening, and we're going to kind of walk through this a little bit, and what Paul says by way of response to it as well, is that what Paul is describing in the sort of declining moments of the social fabric of the Roman Empire is a really great fit for contemporary Western culture as well. I just am amazed in reading the letters of the New Testament, and this in particular, just how easy it is to relate to the things that Paul's saying. It's just almost as though he's writing to us. Well, because he is just writing to us, because this is something that the Spirit of God is leading him to write. There's a similarity between people across cultures and across time. We can relate to these things that he's saying about the culture of his own day. And the center of it, the core of it, that he's pointing out is, he says, people are lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And so, you know, at least we can say in the last days that there's still love, right? That's important. But what kind of love? What do we mean by love? And so it really gets at the whole kind of subtext of the entire Bible, is that there's a cosmic divide. There is a contention. And the contention is this. God is saying, I created human beings in my image to share in who I am as a personal God. And so there's incredible dignity to what it means to be a human being. But the gift of being human and having consciousness and rationality and a moral awareness and the free will to make your own life's decisions carries with it also a danger. God was aware of this danger, that we could use these God-given attributes not to continue as a creature to draw our life from God as he intended. That is his design. But on the other hand, to look to ourselves and say, well, I don't really need to answer to anyone else. Look how magnificent I am. And it should really be all about me. And the Bible declares that this is really at the core of the spiritual divide that exists in our universe. Human beings find themselves right at the center of this, the outworking of this incredible dispute between God and his adversary, who we call Satan, which means adversary. And so we've got two voices coming to us. One saying, it's all about you. You are what it's all about. You live for you. And the other saying, man, that sounds great, but that's really very destructive. That's not the way God intended for you to be. He intended for you to draw your life from him. That is really what is going on below the surface. That's the thing that really drives history right here. And so Paul here is talking about a humanity that's been more or less freed to and given over to this whole self-love, this love of possessions, this love of pleasure. And really, it's all about cultivating the self. That's the word that's reused, you know, used consistently throughout this text here, the self-life, which really has a couple of important values. One is esteem, this inalienable right to feel good about yourself. To be a lover of self is to believe that, you know, I am important in my own right. And that what's very important is that for people to see just how special and valuable and important I am. And so we live in a culture today, much like the first century Roman world, where feeling good about myself is just something that's a goal in life. And if I'm not feeling good about myself, then that I've got a problem that I need to go to a counselor. I need to get that fixed, because at the end of the day, this is the thing that really matters. I need to feel good about me. And then with that, also a commitment to personal happiness, personal well-being. That's what's really being described here, That's consistent with the literature coming from secular sources in the first century world, the Epicureans, the Stoics, and others writing at this time. This is exactly the kind of thing that they were saying. It's the same sort of thing that we find in the popular media today as well. Pop psychology, pop religion, all these things are orienting around the need, and parenting especially, the need for us to feel good about ourselves and to experience well-being. And that is the central goal in life, essentially. And if we're at that place, then phew, we've made it. Well, there are implications, of course, to an unreserved commitment to self, lovers of self, and of pleasure and of acquisition. In other words, that once we make that commitment in our hearts, which we make sort of implicitly, you know, we're just a part of a culture that promotes this kind of thing. It's all about these things. Just read the advertising. What sells is exactly the things that we're going to provide for you, esteem and happiness. But with that comes a very expensive price tag. And this is what Paul is trying to caution Timothy about, because with the self-love as the drive, it produces certain outworkings in our character, which he calls here these things: boastful, arrogant, reviling, disobedient, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, gossips, all that stuff. And so what I want to do is just briefly kind of think these things through together and discuss them in terms of the sort of the dimensions of self-love as it's worked out in reality. That Paul is saying that there's an inner corruption that occurs. When that's our game plan, when the base of my life is self-love, it's all about me, that there's a corruption that happens in our emotional life, in our intellectual life, in our spiritual life. And that then reverberates into our relationships as well. And so what is so true of a self-love culture is that it's relationally so desperately broken and so difficult for people to get along with other people. And because why? Because if everyone's committed to self-love, that's not a basis upon which a relationship can be built. We're just sucking each other dry. And then once we realize there's nothing left to take, puh, and we move on to the next. It's very predatory. Also, and importantly, that the life of self-love and the value of self-love, it just has desperate spiritual implications as well. And these are the things then that Paul is going to bring out, the characteristics on the personal level of living in these last days. And as I say in the outline here, this is the air that we breathe. We don't even have to think about these things. It's just that is the way that the world comes to us. That's the value system of our culture. That's the way that we are taught to think. So let's break this down a little bit. Under inner corruption, he talks about the lack of self-control. He talks about people being brutal, treacherous, and hating good, reckless, conceited. What do these mean? Well, the lack of self-control, anemero in the Greek, it just means that here's a person who's a slave to their impulses. If I feel something, an urge, a desire, well then, man, I got to go out and satisfy that desire. And here's a person then that can't distinguish between things that they want and things that they need, just being led around by the nerve endings, by the need, the perceived need, which is not really a need, a want to feel good physically, especially, and to get involved in things that confuse real needs from wants. And so we find ourselves as a culture in this terrible state of indebtedness. Why? Not because we've thought this out, but because we can't distinguish between the things that we want and the things that we know that we need. Unable, as a culture, we're very infantile in this way. You know, young children have no impulse control. When they want something, they just take it. I mean, if you sit in a group of toddlers like we have out there, you see that left to themselves, they're savages, these animals are. They'd go out and they'd just rip out of another kid's hand whatever they've got. Ooh, shiny, I want it. You know, and without any sense that my gratification should come through effort on my part, not just stealing from somebody else. And so parenting is a really big part of parenting is helping our young people cultivate the ability to delay gratification for the sake of something more important, right? We don't want our kids growing up like grown-up babies, like some of us are still kind of dealing with that at 50 or whatever. I find myself struggling in that way. Lack of self-control. Brutal, treacherous, hating good. That's very strong language to describe a people who just have no moral compass at all. Everyone and everything exists for the desire or the amusement of self. There's a term that we use for this. It's called a sociopath. Here's a person, you know, they just don't operate in moral terms. They just see what they want and they take it. And if that means, you know, using you or using your body for a period of time to accomplish what I want, then yeah, that's what I'm going to be doing. That's what I'm going to be about. Without any sense of remorse or guilt for the way that we treat people. It's just a pathetic kind of a situation. It seems like in a lot of ways in this area, as any meaningful sense of community in our own culture is sort of disintegrating, that we're seeing a rise in just this very kind of thing. For instance, we know that poverty does not immediately equate to violence. What equates to violence is not how much money a person makes, but it's the kind of culture that they live in. And to the extent that we have aimless, structureless cultures, we end up just creating a whole group of people that just have not learned what it means to live in society cooperatively with one another. A desperate problem. Such people, he says, are reckless. They can't connect their results to their actions. Where you got these guys going around, they're doing the stupidest things imaginable, like diving into a cesspool of human filth. Why? To say that they did it. Reckless, completely insane, thoughtlessly driven by whatever impulse is there. That daring culture, that taking risks culture. We don't care about what might happen. We don't care about who might be relying on us or what positive role we can play. It's all just about the thrill of the moment. And he says, conceited. Hatuas in the Greek. That should sound familiar because in the English it means haughty. That's what he's talking about here. A conceited person is a self-absorbed person. They have an overestimated view of their importance. And so here, you know, this is the person who just kind of views themselves as the standard and either you measure up to my standard, in which case you're acceptable as a friend, or you don't, and therefore I reject you. And every strata of society has this haughtiness, this conceit that there is a standard that we judge a person by, and that standard is what? That standard is just, you know, myself, my own desires, my own interests. And so there's a conceit that drives this arrogance of people who are self-love. Because why? Because I am the standard. There's nothing to look to outside of myself to determine what matters or who matters and what does not or who does not. So that's the inner life that Paul is describing here at this time in human society where God is saying, I'm giving you limited freedom to pursue what you will pursue. And fallen people, people alienated from God, who see themselves as the integration point, self-love as the starting point, have this sort of inner life. This is not unfamiliar turf, people. We see this in the people around us. In our honest moments, we see this in ourselves as well, don't we? We realize, I'm kind of like that too. We'll have to speak to that later. Well, when we work out of this kind of deep commitment to self, it has relational implications. And these are things that Paul describes along those lines, arrogant and boastful. So the person who is a self-lover is going to be self-promoting. There's an arrogance there, the propping themselves up. A weak person in need of being viewed a certain kind of way. And so we jockey and maneuver. We find ways to flaunt our status, our wealth, our looks, whatever it is that might give us an edge that makes us think, what really matters is me and my uniqueness. I had a really interesting interaction with my daughter. This has been several years ago now. She was in adolescence. She was about 14, maybe 15. We had this interaction. We were talking about school, and she's really good at some things, and she's really not in others. And she compares herself to her friends. And she compares herself to her brother. And she compares herself to her parents. And you get the picture? Okay. So she sits down. She's pretty upset. She goes, "Dad, the thing that is important that I need to figure out is how is it that I am unique in myself and better than anyone else at something?" And I think that virtually every kid comes to that place. And so what do you say at that stage of the game? "Oh, honey, you are the most beautiful girl in the world." Well, I'm tempted to say that because in sort of my eyes she is, but I know that in a broader sense that's not true. She's not the most beautiful. She's not the most brilliant. She's not the most creative. She is all of those things, but not with the most. And so to be able to come alongside and say, "Sweetie, I love you, and your identity has nothing to do with your uniqueness, with your special talents. I love you because you are a child of God and you're my child. And if we choose any other base to work out of, you're always going to be comparing yourself. You're never going to add up and you will always be disappointed." And this is a big deal. We are raising a generation of boastful arrogance in our culture, because that's what we have bought into, that my kid has to be the best at this and win at that and all this other kind of stuff. Very dangerous. Very dangerous. And so I just want to put this out here as something that's significant. We have embraced these kinds of things. We think in those terms. Our children do as well. We can really help them by addressing this in a direct way. He talks about relational weakness as being people who are revilers and gossips. Blasphemoi. Blasphemy, that's where that word comes from. To revile. Just to say mean, cutting, awful things about people, whether true or not, to others who don't need to know. That's what gossip is. Gossip is often untrue and it's almost always imbalanced. But gossip is basically just talking about somebody who's not in a position to help, not in a position to understand, and you're just talking crap about somebody. And that's the way kind of people are. Oftentimes, it's a disdain for other people. It's glorying in their problems. "Oh, did you hear about blah, blah, blah? Oh, man, they lost it completely in the market. They're destitute." this kind of thing. We see someone else succeed and we're like, "Oh man, I got to bring them down a few notches. They're going to get ahead and I'm going to have to humble them." So you say some snarky things to somebody about that. I really love what the writer Edith Schaefer said years ago. My wife and I got married. We read this book by her and she said, Here's an important lesson in marriage. Some things must never be said. And I'm like, you know, that is so true. When we say things, cutting things, words that penetrate deeply into the heart of another person. And you can be as sorry as you want, but that word has done damage and to that person and in that relationship. And that's blasphema. That is this kind of mean mouth reviling that just tears people down. You know, think about your close relationships. How do you talk to the people in your life that you say you love, that you care for? Are you able to control how you react to them, especially in anger and disappointment, things like that? This is a big deal. This destroys relationships. He says of those who are lovers of self that they are unloving to others, that they are irreconcilable or astorgoi. Storge is a word for love in the Greek language. He says basically it's a loveless person. A person irreconcilable who is utterly also without humility, lacking human affection or real human understanding. It's this ability, you know, I have deep insight into myself, and that's how I think as I think about me. But I don't have that ability to really understand what's going on in the hearts and in the deep places in the lives of other people. You know, so many of us really need to just shut up and listen. And because why? Because we lack understanding, because we're so deeply committed to ourselves that we've got this grid. Everything that we hear goes through this grid of I've got to prop up my ego, I've got to be right, I can't lose an argument, things must be my way, and so forth, that we're unable to really capture the depth and the soul of another person. That's what he's really describing here, this sense of utter being affected by what's going on in another person's soul. And for that reason, then, irreconcilable, that we've got these differences and I haven't been able to bend you to my will to do my things, and so I don't know where to go with this thing. I guess we're done. I guess we're over. I guess we've reached that impasse. See you. Have a nice life. And just how lacking in humility that is, the life of self-love. Disobedient. He says specifically disobedient to parents, but it's a broader thing as well. It has to do with authority. It has to do with defiance. Defiance. We can't subordinate ourselves to others. I like the way John Stott is a famous British writer. He's died recently, but he's written a very beautiful exposition of 2 Timothy. And in it, he describes this phenomenon of defiance. He says, here's a person who can't subordinate themselves to others, born, he says, out of chronic ingratitude. And I think, you know, yeah, that's exactly right. It's the person who's got that edge on, that chip on their shoulder, that sort of constant nagging, oh yeah, you know, in their heart. I feel like I know this kind of person very well because I am that person. You know, when someone says, hey man, you need to do X, what immediately pops into your mind? Not X. Who are you? Oh yeah? You know, and so if you're one who just absolutely disdains the thought of yielding to somebody else's say-so in your life, you've got a problem with defiance. And a lot of this, again, is born out of this kind of chronic ingratitude where it's just like, you know, we look to the people in our lives and we're asking, what have you done for me lately? How do you support my cause? How are you pulling my wagon? And so when we're seeing that people are not there for me and for my purposes and my agenda, then we don't want anything to do with them. And so there's this issue of gratitude that draws us toward people and outside of ourselves. And when we are lacking in gratitude and we are just stuck in this place of self-love, that other people, you know, owe us things. There's always that sense of being a victim or being owed something, but there's not that deep sense of gratitude for the other, and that is at the source of the defiance that is in so many of our hearts. So many of you are just walking away from relationships because somebody said something that if you were honest, you would say it was true, but because it was said, that's it. You know, that might be true, but who are you to say it? Or whatever. You know, that's what I find. You know, I look back over relationships that I have within my family and out, even with close colleagues, for instance, that I've known for many years. And I will find myself at odds with them, not because the things that they have to say to me are false, not untrue at all. It's just because, how dare you say that? How come you didn't say the 15 things that are good before you got to that? You know, or whatever. We got these love demands. This is what he's talking about here. Just that defiance in our heart. The spiritual implications are significant. He says unholy. That's a religious word. Anasoi. And it just means totally secular, irreverent, sometimes it's translated. And here the idea is just that for a person who's deeply committed to self, God is just not a part of the calculation. We just don't think in terms of, gosh, I wonder what God would think about this situation that I'm in. I wonder how God might factor into this decision I need to make. You know, we're just thinking totally in terms of what is there for me. And that's kind of what he's getting at there, this dismissive attitude. You know, when we talk to people, you know, and this topic of God comes up, there's often just this kind of, I'm biting on lemons that comes over people. It's not neutral. People are not neutral about God. And because why? Because there's competition that we sense in our heart between a creator who is calling me to draw my life from him and my own twisted heart that says, I'm first. And so the unholy person is just has this kind of dismissive irreverence toward God. And, well, it's pretty amazing sometimes. I won't go into that. Yeah, I will. A number of years ago, we had a close friend, my wife and I did. I worked with her. I was a bloodsucker for years, all the way through college and graduate school. And drawing blood from people. And I had a colleague that I worked with. And I would share my faith with her, and we became friends. And after work one night, my wife and her and the three of us went out to dinner. And we were just talking about our stories, about how we came to meet God through Christ. She picked up the Bible that we had sitting on the table, and she heaved it across the room and uttered the most profane thing I've ever heard about God. And it shocked me. But she said, you know, and this is interesting, she said, I'm just being honest with you. That is what's in my heart, and I guarantee you that the vast majority of the people that you talk to feel the same way, they're just not as honest. And I thought, wow, man, that might be true. That's a disturbing thought. But it's always stuck with me that you know, no one is neutral about God. How about you? Think about this, you know, do you find yourself feeling that God is drawing you to something that you're just absolutely resistant to? You're like, no, I can't. I lose self. I lose control. It's my life. And when that's going on, we've got a serious contention with God. For that reason, then, we can't deny the spiritual. No culture ever has. And so Paul describes, he says, that we become religious without substance. He says that we worship a form of God but deny its power. It's spirituality without content. It's spirituality that's really not about God at all. It's just about self-discovery. probably the most famous voice in spirituality in our culture today is the late Joseph Campbell, who wrote a very influential book called The Power of Myth, and he describes it like this. He says, all of these wonderful images, that is, in the religions of the world, he says, are referring to something, he says, in you. Nothing about God, something in you. When your mind is simply trapped by the image, that is to say, your creed, your beliefs, whatever, out there, so that you never make the reference to yourself, you've misread the image. In other words, all faith in God is essentially self-empowerment. It's all about you. And, of course, this is the inspiration behind the Star Wars sequence there, you know, the Star Wars spirituality, the Force, all that kind of stuff comes from Joseph Campbell and his work. It absolutely pervades our culture. I'm getting in touch with my spiritual side, some people will say. And, you know, spirituality is good, but it's really the same thing as self-discovery, self-improvement, things like that. That's our culture. We are doing exactly the same things that Paul was describing. And for that reason, then, he says, we're always learning but never coming to a knowledge of the truth. So we're learning but not finding. We're pseudo-seeking. So as with self-centered, a person who's deeply committed to themselves is deeply lost. Because you're not going to find God within. That's not how that works. God isn't found within. God is found as we set our sights outward and we plead with Him. I love the way the psalmist puts it. Psalm 130 says, out of the depths I have cried out to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my requests. If you, Lord, should mark faults, who could stand? But there is forgiveness in you. See, that's what real seeking is. It's not trying to discover my inner divinity or why I'm so important and should be worshipped or whatever. Real seeking is just this simple thing where in the humility of our hearts, we cry out to God. And like the psalmist says, you know, hear me. I know that if you marked faults, I could never stand. But there is forgiveness in you. And so seeking God is seeking forgiveness. It's seeking reconciliation. It's seeking new life in Christ. This is God's invitation to you here tonight. That is that we stand outside of a relationship with God. And to be a Christian in the biblical sense, not the sociological sense where you join a church, but in the biblical sense, is to do exactly what the psalmist is describing here and saying, God, I realize that I stand before you alienated. I stand before you as one who's lived my life on the authority of my own self-love. And I see in that whole list of things that Paul describes, you know, a lot of that's really like me. I really am like that. And I see that that has created a barrier between me and you where I'm guilty. And so I'm asking God, on the basis of the death that Christ died for me, will you forgive me? Will you come into my life? That's what it means to be a Christian in that biblical sense of the word. It's coming to an end of self, not to be consumed with self. Now, in describing then this perilous place of a world that is alienated from God, Paul then turns his attention to Timothy, and I want to just say a few things here by way of closing. He says in verse 10, now you followed my teaching, conduct, purpose, faith, patience, love, perseverance, persecutions, and suffering, such as happened to me when I was in the city of Antioch, the region of Iconium and Lystra, and what persecutions I endured, and out of them all the Lord rescued me. The key here is he's turning his focus now to Timothy, Paul, as he's saying, now you. And then he describes his own experience that Timothy, as a longtime friend of Paul, also participated in. He makes a very important point here, that relationships and the relationship that Paul had with Timothy really is what keeps us sane. It keeps us out of that place that we've been describing, that loathsome place of self-love that he has laid out. It's a key theme in this letter, that the most important things are learned in the context of relationship. In chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, Paul said to Timothy, he says, "The things that you heard and saw in my presence," he says, "these entrust to faithful people who will be able to teach others also." The whole deal is relational. How do we learn to be the kind of people who are different than the utterly engulfed by self of the rest of the culture? Not by reading a book and deciding to be different. It's we learn it in the context of relationship. And Paul is sharing his experience that Timothy was intimately familiar with in this set of verses right here. It's active learning instead of passive learning. To learn passively is just to sit by and take it in. And that's how we learn to become lovers of self. Because that message is everywhere we turn. Everyone wants to tell us that we're the one that matters, so we should buy this product. You're so cool, you're so important, you know, that you should do this thing. You know, be an army of one or whatever crazy, incomprehensibly stupid thing. We're being told, we eat it up because it resonates with that self-love. And so there's that need to be active in our learning, and that occurs in relationship. If you are isolated relationally, if no one knows the struggles of your own self-love, good luck. You will see very little real change in your life, because we learn to get outside of that unquestioned commitment to self in the context of loving relationships, committed relationships with other people. That's how that happens. And so Paul, you know, just presents to Timothy a very pleasing alternative to this life caught up in self. And he describes it this way, you know, that there's a teaching, there's purpose, there's faith. In other words, there's content to build on. Content that's not all about you. "Why are you in despair, O my soul?" the psalmist asks in Psalm 43. Primarily because you're completely preoccupied with yourself. That's why. That's why. And so to really build on a new foundation, to build on the foundation of Christ, means that we're saying, "I'm not the be-all and end-all. I'm not the source of all truth. I'm not the thing that matters most in the cosmos. There is a God who is calling me into relationship with him, and to draw my life from that relationship with him." That's where purpose comes. Not doing things my way to fulfill my self-realization or whatever, but to give myself, present myself to the God who created me and who loves me, so that he could form me into the person he intended. That's a very different place. You follow my teaching, my purpose, my faith. Then he says, you know, "and my conduct." And so he talks then again about this example that he is to Timothy. And then very importantly, patience and love. How do we become unself-possessed? By having that outward focus. Love. The love that the Bible describes is selfless love. It's love that puts the needs and the interests of other people above your own. To say your needs are more important than mine. I'm here to serve you. And when we are prepared to act like that, and where we have relationships that are built on that kind of self-giving love, then we find a kind of a pleasure, a satisfaction. It's not like we lose who we are. It's that really we find who we are as we give ourselves without the merit of being earned by another person, we give ourselves to them, and we seek to meet their needs. And in doing that, there's an intimacy that builds. There's a connection that happens. There's something that's sustaining and beautiful in that relationship and enables us to be patient, to have that long view of people, just as we hope that people have that long view of us. And lastly, you know, it's in the context of relationship where we learn perseverance, persecutions, how to deal with that, rejection, suffering. I was talking to friends recently, and one of them was saying, you know, I'm at this place in my life, I've experienced some very difficult things, and I realized that the people who are able to speak to me in a helpful way are people who suffered and who've experienced some desperate times in their own life. And they have been able to find God's mercy and God's comfort in that context. And it's that we need to have relationships where we are suffering together, where we are standing together in the difficult times of life, because that's how we're going to find out how do we trust God. Not by avoiding suffering, not by taking another pill and another vacation and whatever it is you're looking to somehow make it all go away, but to learn what does it mean to really, truly come to God authentically in my suffering and in the sense of rejection I may be feeling, persecution he talks about here, and just entrust myself to him in the context of a framework of relationships where people get that, they understand that, and we can move forward together. And there's something beautiful about that. That's reality, people. That's reality. And God is calling you into reality here tonight. Not the life of pseudo-seeking self-love where it's all about you, but it's that decision that we need to make, each one of us, and renew that decision to say, you know, God, I want your thing and your way in my life. I don't want to be given over to the ugliness of self-love.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.